If I could tell you something about the art and the act of preaching, I would tell you that every single week, our pastors create a new portrait, a new masterwork, if you will. It is something brand new. It's been created, perhaps over time, but certainly by that week. And we, the congregation, expect one of those every single week. Time after time after time, week after week after week. And those who preach bear the responsibility of not simply explaining the text of 3,500 years ago, but also to understand what does that text mean today. So as a preacher, you're always concerned with what does it mean for them then and for us now. Both need to be communicated at the same time and in the same message. In this particular circumstance, in this passage in Deuteronomy chapter 10, we have an opportunity to see one of those instances where what is said 3,500 years ago has immediate and direct application for us, because it is not only said in Deuteronomy, but throughout the prophets by Jesus and his apostles. Follow along with me, if you will. Deuteronomy chapter 10, I will be reading from the English Standard Version. At that time, the Lord said to me, "Cut for yourself two tablets of stone like the first, and come up to me on the mountain and make an ark of wood. And I will write on the tablets the words that were on the first tablets that you broke, and you shall put them in the ark." So I made an ark of acacia wood and cut two tablets of stone like the tablets in my hand. And he wrote on the tablets in the same writing as before, the Ten Commandments that the Lord had spoken to you on the mountain out of the midst of the fire on the day of the assembly. And the Lord gave them to me. And then I turned and came down from the mountain and put the tablets in the ark that I had made, and there they are as the Lord commanded me. The people of Israel journeyed from Bereth Benajakan to Masorah, and there Aaron died, and there he was buried, and his son Eleazar ministered as priest in his place. From there they journeyed to Gudgada, from Gudgada to Jotbethim, a land with brooks of water. At that time the Lord set apart the tribe of Levi to carry the ark of the covenant of the Lord, to stand before the Lord, to minister to him and to bless him in his name to this day. Therefore Levi has no portion or inheritance with his brothers. The Lord is his inheritance, as the Lord your God has said to him. I myself stayed on the mountain as at the first time, 40 days and 40 nights, and the Lord listened to me that time also. The Lord was unwilling to destroy you. And the Lord said to me, "Arise, go on your journey at the head of the people, so that they may go in and possess the land which I swore to their fathers to give them." And now, Israel, what does the Lord your God require of you? But to fear the Lord your God, to walk in all his ways, to love him, to serve the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and to keep the commandments and statutes of the Lord, which I'm commanding you today for your good. Behold, to the Lord your God belong the heaven and the heaven of heavens, the earth with all that is in it. Yet the Lord set his heart in love on your fathers and chose their offspring after them, you above all peoples as you are this day. Circumcise therefore the foreskin of your heart and be no longer stubborn. For the Lord your God is God of gods and Lord of lords, the great, the mighty, the awesome God, who is not partial and takes no bribe. He executes justice for the fatherless and the widow, and loves the sojourner, giving him food and clothing. Love the sojourner, therefore, for you were sojourners in the land of Egypt. You shall fear the Lord your God, you shall serve him and hold fast to him, and by his name you shall swear. He is your praise, he is your God. Who has done for you these great and terrifying things that your eyes have seen? Your fathers went down to Egypt 70 persons, and now the Lord your God has made you as numerous as the stars of heaven. This last week, the Washington Post ran an article about the Chief Justice of the United States, John Roberts. And it wasn't the normal article where they were opining on his opinions about any given case. They were actually recording his commencement address to his son's ninth grade graduation. Here he is, the U.S. Chief Justice, giving the graduation address to ninth graders at the Cardigan Mountain School in New Hampshire. And invested, of course, as you are in graduation addresses, and you can read this editorial or this article on WAPO, Washington Post, or you can watch it on YouTube. I encourage that. Here is the Chief Justice explaining to young boys various tips and pieces of advice that he might give them. He said, for instance, this is an all-boys school, he said, but most of you are going to be going to schools where there are girls. He said, I have no advice for you. But then he said this, you may not have been privileged young men when you came to this school, but leaving this prestigious institution, you are privileged now. You are privileged young men, but don't act like it. You are privileged young men, don't act like it. In our culture, privilege is thought to be bad. Privilege is something that we considered, we want to guilt people by their privilege. We want to say they have this or they are that, and therefore this is incumbent upon them to be this way or have this particular response. But as always, our culture gets this wrong. Our culture does not understand what privilege really is. And so when we consider this concept of privilege within the scope of Deuteronomy, we're really talking about binge-watching TV. Now, before you wonder where in the world I'm going with that, understand that when you binge-watch TV, you watch episode after episode after episode. In my case, however, because I'm more forgetful, perhaps, than other people, I really depend on those little pieces at the beginning of each episode that say, now, previously on... Because I forgot what he did and she said. You know, I just forget. So I really need that. The key scenes, the flashbacks, the earlier episodes. Yeah, catch me up. And then you have this in Deuteronomy 10, verses 1 through 11, this idea that we're going to go back in time and give you all these flashbacks. These are the kinds of things that happened. This is what we did. This is where we went. Now, I'm going to say to you and ask you to do something now that most preachers will not ask you to do. This might come as a real shock and surprise, but I would actually like you to take out your cell phones. And I would like you to take your favorite picture in your gallery, however your gallery is arranged. And in your favorite picture, I would like you to take your thumb and your index finger, and I would like you to expand and contract that picture. Expand and contract, expand and contract. Zoom in, zoom out. That process that you just did on your cell phone is exactly what Deuteronomy 10, 1 to 11 is doing. It's expanding and contracting time. It's saying to us, these are all of the things that happened back in Exodus and Numbers and the first few chapters in Deuteronomy. I'm just going to catch you up on those episodes that you might have missed. Here is a flashback to help us through this particular process. And here are some of the things that we are to do. We are not to forget where we've come from. That is Egypt, the wilderness, Canaan. We are not to forget whose we are. We've been given the Ten Commandments, the priesthood, a new land. And of course, the most important of all of this is the meaning of covenant. The last phrase that comes out of verse 11 is, I swore these things to your forefathers that I would give them to you. You see, covenant in Hebrew is this marvelous word, chesed, which means covenant loyalty. I will never leave you. I will never give you up. No matter what you do, I will do this. This is the marvel of what it means to have privilege. God has given privilege, that is, benefits to his people. God-given gifts to his people. That's what privilege is. But here's the twist. The twist is that the benefits given to his people are now to be given to others. We give to other people now that the benefits have been given to us. So I must say that for as long as I've been teaching First Testament teaching, Old Testament teaching, that I've really focused on some of the major misconceptions that people have about Old Testament, First Testament teaching. And I'd like to rehearse them because they really do apply to this concept that we're in Deuteronomy about privilege. So the misconception number one is that we have done something to earn our privilege. If you go back to Deuteronomy 6 and 8, you see God saying things like, you didn't build those houses. You didn't dig that well. You didn't plant that vineyard. I gave it to you. The first misconception is that somehow privilege is works-centered. It is not about our works at all. It has nothing to do with us. God gave it all. The second misconception, not only about them, but also for us, is that privilege makes us better than other people. To which I want to say, yeah, right. Deuteronomy chapter 7, man. Deuteronomy chapter 7. What's God say? I didn't choose you because you were the biggest and the best. I chose you because I set my hesed upon you. I set my affection on you. I set my covenant loyalty on you. No matter what you do, I will always keep that oath. That's the misconception, that somehow we have this self-centered view of life and things. And the third misconception is that external forms of obedience display our privilege. This is not formula-centered. If you go back to Deuteronomy chapter 5, what are we given there? We're given the Ten Commandments again. A second time, of course, because this is a brand new generation of people getting them. And these Ten Commandments are given to them that they are to change the internal nature of the individual person. As people, we are to be transformed from the inside out. There is no legislative code of laws and precepts that you must keep in order to gain acceptance with God. These are things that God has given. They are not formula-centered. There is no focus on sacrifices or worship or services or any of this stuff. Now, most of us have been given privilege in one way or another. And some of us have multiple privileges. Some of us maybe we just have one privilege. But whatever privilege it is that we've been given, our responsibility is to benefit others with the privilege that's been given to us. So this week I wrote out just 10 privileges that just came to my mind of things that I think are generally speaking benefits to people that we could give to others. Now, as I read this list of privileges, consider if you have those privileges, then what might you do with them with others? So here they are. Number one, if you grew up or are growing up with loving, kind, generous parents, then what will you do with that benefit for others? Two, if you've been given monies beyond your means for living, your needs for living, what will you do with that? Number three, if you've had the opportunity for a good education, what will you do with it? Number four, if you have job stability or job security, what then? What if you have a good reputation, a good standing, a good status in the community or in your workplace? What do you do with that? If you have a mentor in your life, or if you have great amounts of free time that are yours to do with as you please, if you've been given great freedom to travel, or if you have physical skills, a strong body, and you're pain-free, what will you do with that? Or perhaps another privilege, if you can write, communicate, and speak. What will we do with the privileges given to us? Will we benefit others with those privileges? Because, of course, privilege ought to change us. Now, there's a certain structure to this particular passage that's quite unique. And it's one of these structures that always makes me think about being a teacher. Because for all of the years of being a teacher, I have heard this statement, this question made over and over and over again so many times that I do the biggest eye roll on Earth's surface whenever I hear it now. And that is, after I've given a syllabus, after I've given the rubrics, after I've explained three times in class, after I've written everything on whiteboards, ad infinitum, ad nauseum, well, what do you want on the paper? What do you want? I don't know. What do you want? Ugh. This is the question. What does God require of you? I don't want to hear. Well, what do you want? I'm going to tell you right here, right now. In fact, this great question actually comes right out of Micah chapter 6 and verse 8. You wonder where Micah got this question? He got it from Deuteronomy chapter 10. What does the Lord your God require of you? He expects you to walk humbly. And all of the rest of those great statements there, he got this right out of Deuteronomy 10. This is the passage. And here's this marvelous two words in English. And now, this summer, for 3 weeks, I spent some time with a great class of graduate students, 16 of us in this particular class, great profs. And it was a writing class. In fact, it's called the Hoosier Writing Project. And so I was with these folks for 3 solid weeks. And I learned so much from them. And one of the things I learned, especially from the poets and the short storytellers, was this: that they depend on something that they refer to as the turn. So you're reading down through their poetry, or you're listening to them read their poetry, and then all of a sudden, there is a sideways shift that takes you 90 degrees in a different direction you never expected. Or in a short story, you're following the story, you're expecting a certain outcome, and then boom, out of left field, you're knocked sideways. That's exactly what's going on with these two words in English, and now. There is a shift coming next, he's saying. This shift is different and unique. In essence, prepare to be blown away. That's the idea of these two little English words. Now, the heart of this is the center of Deuteronomy. And I have to tell you that anytime I preach, I always feel the great weight of preaching, because preaching is a great responsibility and a great privilege. But I feel even more weight this morning, because this passage is the basis for all of the rest of the First Testament. All of what Jesus premised is premised upon Deuteronomy chapter 10. All of what the apostles wrote in their epistles comes out of Deuteronomy chapter 10. This is the heart, this is the substance, this is the ethos of all of what Christianity is about. Christianity is an others-centered religion. We have been given privilege, mighty privilege, but the question is, what will we do with it? The benefits given to us, will we give those to other people? And then there's this richness, this eating this meal for life. Have you ever had this situation where you go out to somebody's house for dinner, and they serve you this dessert. And this dessert is so rich, it makes your teeth hurt. Have you ever had that situation? I've been in places where I take one bite, and I'm thinking to myself, I can't finish this. This is too good. I'm going to have to come back again and again and again to try this over and over and over again. If I could fully express to you the imperative and the importance of this text, it would be like this rich dessert. We would have to come back again and again and again to this. We could spend all day doing this. I promise we won't. This is really important. This text is the centerpiece, really, not only of Deuteronomy, but the rest of the Scriptures. So the concepts that we're drawing here from 2017 are things that were developed in 3,500 years ago, and we shouldn't be surprised by this. There's literally a hymn taking place in Deuteronomy 10, 12 to 22, where there's this flow of thought that's really hard to adequately express in English. So we put it into an outline to give us at least try to flesh this thing out to help us to understand it a little bit better. So here is the question. What does God require? That is the key idea here. Since God has given us this privilege of relationship with Him, what is it that He demands? And simply, it's this. God simply demands allegiance. He demands loyalty. Now, when I go to speak places, depending on where I go, folks who know anything at all about football always ask me, well, how are the Colts doing? And, we'll have great conversation about the Indianapolis Colts. And they'll say, well, because you live in Indianapolis, that's the reason why you're a Colts fan. And I'll say, no, man, that's not why. This is why I'm a Colts fan. When I was 8 years old, I found out Johnny Unitas had my birthday. Johnny Unitas was born on May 7th, baby. That was the coolest thing for a little 8-year-old boy. And so from that time on, I've been a Colts fan. I will die in blue and white because of Johnny U. Loyalty, allegiance. My allegiance to the Colts won't ever fade. And in some small sense of that, this is what Yahweh requires of us. Allegiance, a loyalty that will never, never end. And so we come to this first answer to the question, what does God require? And that is that God gives us our privilege. We always begin with who God is. In fact, we just finished singing a doxology, that is praise to God. In fact, you know that the doxology actually originally had 17 verses? And we only sing one, aren't you happy about that? 17 verses in the first go-round with that hymn. And we sing one, and the most important emphasis here is we give praise to God because this is from whom this comes. All of the privilege that we have, all of the benefits come from Him. So here they are in this triad, this hymn, these 3 points coming through in various places within the hymn. We have first this cosmic creational ownership in verse 14. To the Lord belong heaven and heaven of heavens and earth and all that's in it. There is no room for other gods. There are no other deities. There are no idols to be allowed. This is, by the way, the biggest problem throughout the rest of the First Testament that the Israelites will face, and by the way, so do we, and that is, we are the greatest idol-making factory ever. And we want what we want, and we want to worship the things that we want to worship. And God says, uh-uh, that's not allowed. In fact, if you just take a glimmer back a couple of books earlier, you remember in the book of Exodus, there was something called, the 10 plagues. And the 10 plagues were not directly focused on the Egyptians. They were directly focused on the Egyptian deities. And God was taking them out one by one by one until all 400 were laid bloody on this heavenly playground that people think that they exist on. Everything from the blood in the Nile River to the end of the firstborn, every single Egyptian god was decimated. And so when you think about this cosmic creational ownership, God says, I've already shown you what that's like. This earth, all heavens, everything is mine. End of story. And then there's this next idea of this absolute exclusive lordship in verse 17 where God says, I am the God of gods, the Lord of lords. And it really, this is a powerful statement as well. The first goes back to Egypt and says, don't forget what I did to the Egyptians. This one is about where we're about to go into Canaan. In the original language, it says that there's an El, that is E-L, it's God. And it's a generic form of God in the ancient world. And specifically for the Canaanites, their centerpiece of their pantheon was El. He was the head god. In this phrase, right here in this passage, God is saying, I'm not just El, I am the El. There's actually a definite article in front of the word God. I am the God. There is no other El. I'm the one. This is it. End of story. I am who you're looking for. American culture is a funny culture because we think that somehow what is the latest and greatest is the best thing. A man by the name of Neil Gaiman has been making quite a name for himself over the last few years with writings that he has done, one of which is called American Gods. I haven't read the book, nor have I seen the new series that's coming out, but I have been reading articles about him, and specifically, I read an interview by him. And I want to mention this because when you think about American gods, this whole very much of a bloody, violent story, according to him, gods roaming the earth, seeking whom they may devour. Does that sound vaguely familiar, by the way? But Jesus doesn't show up in Gaiman's book. And this is what he said about that when he was asked, I wrote a scene with Jesus in it, but he didn't fit the story. And so I took him out. He didn't fit the story. Man, what's up? Come on. You know why he doesn't fit the story? Because he's not like any of the other gods. The other gods don't exist. He is the only God. And therefore, Gaiman's right. Yeah, I took him out. He didn't fit. Sure, he didn't fit. Of course he didn't fit. And then there's this witnessed dominant worship in this verse in verse 21. It says that you have seen great and terrifying things with your own eyes. Imagine being in the Cairo Times or the Babylonian Post or the Nineveh Gazette, and you're getting this news about something that happened down at the Red Sea where the whole Egyptian army got slaughtered. And all the journalists are going down there with their cameras, you know, and video, and they're filming the carnage of soldiers floating on top of the water and chariot pieces hither and yon. The terrifying things you have seen with your eyes, don't miss that. The idea of the power of God's actions against those who would raise up their voice against him. And here's this little phrase. It says, he is your praise, your God. Now, this is a strange thing to me because if we're following through this passage, this is written to the Israelites. And so you would expect that this would say, you, this is your praise, this is your God. But no, it's in a third person singular. He is your God. This is fascinating. Why is that? I honestly think that this statement is made by the other people groups watching what's happening to Israel. We find it starting in actually Deuteronomy chapter 4, verses 6 to 8, where it says there that Israel was given a law unlike the law of any other land, and the people were amazed by this law. And then Deuteronomy actually ends in this way. In Deuteronomy chapter 33, there's this long section that's actually praise to Israel and Israel's God from people groups outside of Israel. And here's how it ends. Happy are you, O Israel, who has been saved by Yahweh. You see, everybody else looking at this, Nineveh, Babylon, Cairo, wherever, they're all looking at this going, oh my word, what are we going to do with this? And the only thing to do with this is to understand that there is a need to worship the dominant deity, not only of the day, but of every day. Because this deity has given privilege to his people, and this people group, of course, is then to do exactly this, to give the privilege to other folks. I mentioned a few moments ago this, the first couple of English words in a sentence in verse 12, in verse 17. I wanted to mention this one in verse 15. It's the word yet. Now, you might not think that that's such an important word, but this is what yet means when you're understanding it from Israel getting it the first time. You ready? This is yet. What? You got to be kidding me. Say what? Yeah, that's yet. Right there. This is distinctive. It's emphatic. It's surprising. It's like this little blow-up thing right here in the middle of the text. Wow, this is so cool. This just jumps off the page. And what's jumping off the page? This distinctive heritage. You are above all the peoples. I benefited you. And then drop down to this third thing, this attractive example here. You have this emphasis on group of people who started with 70. They started with 70. And they end up as numerous as the stars of the sky. How do you deal with that? Well, I'm going to give you a sense of how you deal with that. I realize it's not Christmas time, but I would like to tell you about King Wenceslaus. Now, King Wenceslaus was a pretty cool guy. He was born in the 900s. He was a great leader in Bohemia. At that particular time, his dad died. He took over the leadership of his country. He had been taught from his earliest days Christian principles. He began to put these principles into practice. He would, as well as his other leaders, would go around looking for poor people to give alms and monies and clothing and food to. In fact, he started a really cool practice. You might have heard of it. It's called Christmas Eve. Christmas Eve, King Wenceslaus goes out with all of the other folks in the leadership and starts giving to the poor, the people that don't have, the people that aren't privileged, the people that need the benefit. And he starts giving to them. Now, you've probably heard the little tune. Good King Wenceslaus looked out on the feast of Stephen. Remember that? Well, here's the last line of that. Here's the last stanza of that little song. In his master's steps he trod, where the snow lay dinted, heat was in the very sod which the saint had printed. Therefore, Christian men, be sure, wealth or rank possessing, ye who now will bless the poor, shall yourselves find blessing. So here you have this king who is doing good. And if I could be so bold as to say that these two verses in Deuteronomy 10, verses 18 and 19, are so emphatic, so surprising, so out of the world different from anything else going on in the ancient culture of the day, that I would say that these two verses highlight not only who God is, but who God's people should be from 3,500 years ago to today. There should be no stoppage of answer to this question, what does God require of us? Let's unpack a few of these ideas here because there are four major ideas. The first is that he shows no partiality. In the ancient world, when you went to court and you were brought up on charges, the judge would literally come to right in front of you and lift your face. That's what this word means, no partiality, or the word partiality. It means to lift your face so I can look at you and identify you, and because of what you look like or what side of the tracks you come from, I'm going to label you and discriminate against you based on who you are and where you've come from. And God says, I don't lift the face. I do not discriminate. There is no partiality with me. Unlike all of the other gods and all of the other ancient world civilizations of the time, God was totally different. Number two, it says that I take no bribes. All the way through the Bible, it's really an interesting study. If you just do a study on bribery, how many times God says, I don't do that? And then think about your favorite hero movie. And, you know, the whole thing is coming to an end, culmination, you know, of this big event, the big fight where all the bad guys are going to die. And the bad guys try one more time to get to the hero, and they try and buy him off. And the hero says, I can't be bought. That's exactly what Yahweh is saying. You can't buy me. And there's a third idea here, this fatherless widow orphan. The idea is that there's no man to protect. If you're living in a patriarchal society, a man-centered culture, and you don't have any men around, man, you are in bad way. And God says, I am concerned about the underprivileged, the marginalized, and the most vulnerable of all of the people. I'm going to take care of those folks. In fact, so much does he say this that he says, I will clothe them. I will give them food. This is unheard of in the ancient Near Eastern pantheon of gods. Gods don't do stuff like this. They're all about themselves. Yahweh is totally different. And then there's this fourth idea, the idea of the sojourner, the alien, the outsider, the one who has no family. God extends the same privilege. Get this. This just blows me away. God uses the same word that he says about his people earlier in the chapter, and he says, I am giving my hesed, my covenant loyalty to these people as well. Wow, that just doesn't happen. This is unheard of in the ancient world. You don't do stuff like this. But God says, this is it. I want you to know that this is what you ought to be doing. And then he turns around and says, I'm going to do this for the sojourner, and now I want you to do this for the sojourner. At the Comenius Institute, we have a radio show every week, and it's on Wednesday morning from 10 until noon. And we promote it on Tuesday evening and then Wednesday morning, and the podcast comes out later. And we have all different kinds of Christian folk coming in from all around Indianapolis. And the whole point of the radio show and all of the guests is based on Titus chapter 3. Do good, do good, do good. How are you doing good in Indianapolis to demonstrate the gospel to people? My producer, H.B. Bell. H.B. is a marvelous brother who is all community all the time. That's his tagline. He's always trying to help people, to bring people together, to form communities that will help each other. I think about the folks down near 10th Street who have the Isaiah House and the importance of returning citizens and taking care of men who are coming out of prison, giving them shelter and food and a job. And that's what they do down at Brookside Church. And then, of course, some of our own working with ESL, Carmen Howell, up in Noblesville. This is a good work that's being done. Food for Souls, Leon and Dawn from Food for Souls, who are ministering to all the folks in the tent cities around Indianapolis. Do good. The privilege that's been given to you, give to other people. That's what privilege is all about. Well, there is a third issue, and that is our responsibility to change, because privilege ought to bring change in our own lives. I mentioned a moment ago that I was in this writing class in this Hoosier Writing Project this summer for 3 weeks, and I was the first one to give a demonstration, to demonstrate teaching methods and so on within a classroom context. And I used the narrative of Frederick Douglass. For those of you who don't know the narrative of Frederick Douglass, you need to leave this place and run to Amazon and buy it and read it and weep. The narrative of Frederick Douglass is about a slave, his own autobiographical notations about what it was like to be a slave. And so what I did in this particular presentation, we sat in a large circle, there were 16 of us plus our professors, and I had each person read a different part or different section of the narrative of Frederick Douglass. And when we were all finished, I asked for popcorn responses from the folks in the group, and it was all dour and sour. I mean, they just felt awful. There was this depression. Obviously, I mean, when you read things like this, and if it's been a long time since you've read it or you've never read it, this just hits you right between the eyes. My professor wrote to me after the class was over, and he said, "You got after the affective change. You made us feel Frederick Douglass." Now, frankly, I didn't have much to do with it at all. All you have to do is read that book. And if you aren't changed by just reading that book, there's something else wrong, perhaps. It was about the affective, internal feeling, the emotive change that takes place within us. And this is what we're talking about here in these passages in chapter 10, verses 12 and 13. When you read these five words, fear, walk, love, serve, and keep, all of them are about a change of the internal heart of the person. Don't lie, don't steal, don't cheat. Those are all internal directives. Not to mention don't covet, which, by the way, is the only time in the ancient world that any law code actually has a law that you cannot put your finger on, that's not materialistic. Coveting, who can see coveting? Who can touch coveting? You can't, because it's an internal issue. And this is what God is after. For all of the years of my teaching, I've helped my students to understand it's not just about what you know, and it's not just about what you do, it's about your being. So the question is, what should I know, be, and do because of what I've learned? It should change us, whatever it is that's doing, whatever it is that we're studying. And then this little phrase right at the end of this verse, it says, and do this for your own good. For your own good. Parents, kids, how many times have you either heard this or said this? You know, this is for your own good. Kids, you're probably going, man, why'd you have to bring that up? Because I don't want to hear that no more. And parents are going, you know, how many times do I have to say that before it gets through? And that's exactly what we find ourselves here in the text. We have this God who is speaking to us in this framework, in these words, and saying, this is what I'm trying to get through. This is for your own good. And it goes on from there. This idea of corrective change, there are two basic metaphors used here. One of circumcision and one of being stiff-necked. Both of them have to do with correction. Circumcision, stiff-neckedness, this is the kind of thing that's going on all the way through the Old Testament. And you see it over and over again in Jesus' comments, not only about Israel, but about his own people, his own apostles. And then there is this exclusive change. And here in the original language, again, this is what it sounds like. Only Yahweh, only him, only to him, only by his name. It's like getting punched four times right in the face. Only, 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 only. There is an exclusivity about the gospel of Jesus Christ. I can't tell you how many conversations I have had over the years, and specifically even this summer, with people who say to me, well, you know, my ethical system is based on my own desires, I've set my own rules. Or somebody will say, we just need to get together as a community and kind of have a dialogue about what's right and wrong. And I look at them all the same way and I smile and I say, but what if somebody else has a different ethic than you as an individual and they've got more power? Or what if there's a different group and they've got more power? Then what are you going to do? You see, as soon as you abdicate a transcendent standard, that is a standard that comes out from outside of us, You've given it all up. Now you're just waiting for the most powerful person to show up and put everything in line. And let me tell you, we've been through the 20th century. We don't want to see that again. So when I think about the exclusivity of Jesus, there is no way that people can want or claim inclusivity. You can't say, well, we need to be all inclusive, unless you have an exclusive statement or standard that says that. Here it is. As soon as we use the word should, we are declaring an ethical standard or system. As soon as we use the word should. I was on the radio this last week and I was explaining some things about the issue of science. Interview was coming out of Florida, and we were talking about how science has to borrow Christian ethics. And I was referring to a scientist who has her own lab out at UC Berkeley, and she just written this book called Crack in Creation. And I'm reading through this editorial, this article that was written about her in WAPO or New York Times. And in this particular article, she said, it really feels sometimes like we shouldn't be doing this. Shouldn't. You're a scientist. Where did you get your ethics from? As soon as you say the word should, there is a standard for ethics which comes from outside of us. The exclusivity of change only comes from one place. After the Chief Justice told the boys that you are privileged, don't act like it. This is what he said. When you go to your new school, you find the person that's raking the leaves or shoveling the snow or taking out the trash, and you go up to them, you introduce yourself by name, you ask them their name, and for the rest of the time that you are at that school, you greet them by name. What was Chief Justice Roberts saying? Others. You focus your attention. You've been given great privilege to be on this campus. You focus your privilege and your attention to benefit other people, to say that whatever you do, whoever you are an important person because God has made us. So all of the things that we're to remember here, the personal responsibility that we'll be hearing about in weeks to come in Deuteronomy chapters 11 through 34, we would need to remember who has given us privilege. Remember why we've been given this privilege for others. And remember that privileged are responsible for internal change. The privilege is that God has given us gifts to benefit us who then are to turn around and benefit other people. The answer to the question, what does the Lord require of you, rings 3,500 years ago to 2017 and hasn't missed a beat since. It is the loyalty and allegiance that we owe to the one who has given us gifts that we are now to give to benefit others. Privilege should change us. Lord, help us to understand this message. May we take from this place the opportunities we've been given, the places that we have been blessed with, the things that you have anointed us with, the people in our lives, the different directions that you have taken us, the opportunities for time or monies or whatever else it is that we have that we can give. Help us, Lord, now to give in that privileged sense to other people. Help us, Lord, to think of others and acknowledging all of the great gifts that you have given and in the privilege that you have given to us. Help it, Lord, to change us and then to benefit others for you and you alone. We give you the doxology. Amen.